Morning, everyone, and welcome to the first class, first lecture of the Hinduism 2 series. My subtitle is Yoga, Bhakti, and Tantra. The official subtitle in the grade book is Vernaculars, Bhakti Vernaculars. Although the content, the description of what I'm going to give is covered by the content of the grey book, but we're in the process of changing the grey book and the red book to make them correspond to each other. So in case you're wondering about that. There's an outline of the course which I have, which in my rush this morning, I'm afraid I've left in the office. But if you write down your email address, I can send it to you as an email attachment, which outlines each of the program for the coming 8 weeks. What we're going to focus on this term is the question of soteriology, really. Last term we looked at an overall picture of the Hindu traditions. We did a survey, it was a survey course from the Vedas through to modernity in 8 weeks. And this term we're going to focus more closely on certain traditions that we touched on briefly last term. And we're going to examine focus on the idea of soteriology or theories of salvation or liberation in the context of Hinduism, with particular reference to those categories, yoga, bhakti, and tantra. And we are, of course, immediately in difficulty in using the term soteriology, which develops from within Christian theology, and using the term salvation, where the term liberation in secondary literature is much more often used. And what does all this mean? Although the English term has more the connotation, the word liberation perhaps in English has more the connotation of sort of political liberation, a political freeing of prisoners or something, or people from oppression, which is perhaps not intended by any of the Sanskrit terminology. Now, can liberation be seen as a Hindu equivalent to salvation? A second question, what is the justification in thematizing soteriology in India? Why are we doing this? Why am I doing this? Where it might not be an important category. Is it justified to thematize soteriology in the way that I'm intending to do? And to this last question, I think we can fairly unequivocally say that Indian traditions do indeed have semantic equivalence to salvation, expressed by a number of terms. Furthermore, salvation and theories of salvation or soteriologies have been developed within Indian traditions themselves. So when we're studying Indian traditions, we're studying traditions that have already studied themselves, that have always come up with categories for their own self-description and self-understanding. And furthermore, salvation and theories of salvation, or soteriologies, have been developed within the traditions themselves. And they often see salvation or liberation as the highest human good, as the final purusharta, the top, the final human good that should guide all human communities and all human actions. So this course then is about some Indian theories of salvation or liberation, some Indian soteriologies, and what this means, and the understanding of how this goal is attained. And while I will try to offer descriptions within broad historical parameters, the course is not primarily historical. And I will especially today move about through history somewhat in the interest of a preliminary kind of typology. And I realise that typologies are in fact hidden theories, but I do think they're often a good place to begin a historical inquiry. But first, let's briefly examine some of the problems that we encounter before we even start. So some of the problems. First of all, you've got a politics of representation, which is, we're now entering into the, lecture handout that I've got here. The politics of representation. So in the history of the West's relation to India, India has often been perceived as that which is other, wholly other to the West. India has been seen by the West as both mysterious and monstrous. From German Romanticism through to the 20th century, India has been represented in the writings of Western scholars. Can you pass that down? I'm afraid you'll have to share that for now, that one. In the history of the West with India, India has been represented as mysterious and monstrous, both of them. And from German Romanticism through to the 20th century, India has been represented in the writings of Western scholars and colonialists as mysterious, the mystic East, and Indians themselves have not been immune from propagating this idea. Radhakrishnan himself said that the West was material while the East was spiritual, and a plethora of Hindu gurus and Buddhist meditation teachers have reinforced this idea, particularly in the last 50 years or so. So we have this a problematic construction by the West of the East as irrational and mysterious and so on, which we're still in the grip of to some extent. Then you have a post-colonial response against that representation, secondly, is the context in which we must understand this question of soteriology. So the post-colonial response has tended to reject India as the mystic East, as purely a construction of the colonial imagination. In representing India as mystical or spiritual, it thereby reinforces the West as material and powerful, and so able to dominate India. An Indian spirituality serves hegemonically to reinforce the subordination of the subcontinent and to reinforce what Hegel called the master-slave relationship between the West and India. South Asian historians have therefore in recent years been keen to throw off the yoke of this colonial construction and have focused on constructions of power in Indian history, on subaltern classes, on material culture, and on the ways in which India developed nationhood in the face of colonial oppression. So a new historiography has developed which allowed the development of Marxist, post-structuralist and feminist theories to South Asia, which themselves were based on the critique of religion and an atheistic scepticism towards all claims to transcendence of the world. So a lot of these post-colonial theories are based on coming out of Marxism and so on, are based on certain eliminative materialist presuppositions. Now, within Hinduism itself, there's been a rejection of the Western construction of the mystic East in favour of a politicisation of Hinduism in the service of nationalism, along with the sometimes contradictory development of untouchable groups. So within this literature, I think a very good place to begin is Richard King's book, Religion and the Mystic East, Routledge, 1999, which is a very good sort of survey of this whole area. And Ron Inden's book, Imagining India, is a deconstruction, if you like, of the Western construction of India from the history since the 19th century, which is very interesting and useful. Although, having said what's wrong with it all, he doesn't yet present what he thinks is the correct picture, as it were. So it's a corrective reading without the correction yet. And another book, Halfast, a book which isn't there, India and Europe. I think that's a very important book that everyone should read if they're interested in this area, India and Europe. It's a series of his essays on the reception of Indian traditions to the West, particularly German Romanticism, Schlegel and even Coleridge, and who are the two brothers? I can't remember them now. Schleiermacher. There's the two brothers. I can't remember two. Schlegel. It could have been the Schlegel brother. Anyway. Their reception. And the influence of Indian thinking on Romanticism, particularly on German Romanticism. So I'd urge you to look at that. Now, there have been, then, problematic dichotomies in the West's understanding of India that has propagated a number of distinctions, such as that between religion, seen as individual salvation, and politics, between the private realm where religion operates and the public realm of governance, and between the mystical and the material. And we might extend these dichotomies to include the conscious and the unconscious, as Jung did, the male and the female, where each of these pairs is related, although not equivalent to the other pairs. The political, the public, the rational, and the material have arguably been seen in the history of the West as masculine traits, with the religious, the private, the irrational, and the spiritual as feminine traits. It's a bit crude, but that's often a picture that's painted. Post-colonial historiography has reacted against these constructions in an attempt to present a more nuanced and politically aware understanding of Indian civilization. So when we're looking at India, we introduce the notion of religion, for example, into India, and look at Hinduism through the category religion, which we see in terms of salvation or soteriology. But we need to be aware that the category religion itself comes out of a certain history in the West. So when John Locke in the 17th century says, after 30 years of religious war, he says, let's take religion out of the public realm and keep that for the realm of governance and put religion into the private realm. And so who cares what you believe and what you think and what you how you worship and so on. But if we separate them out, that will be better for our sort of collective health, as it were. And we've tended to project that or maintain that secular religious dichotomy when we look at India, and we have to be conscious of that the fault lines may well be different there, or they may be the same, or they may be, but anyway, we have to be aware of that problem. Yet although we might see the mystic East as a construction of the colonial past and the West's imagination that has served to maintain Western sovereignty during the colonial period, we might also like to consider that there was some hook to hang these projections on. And Romanticism's interest in the East, right the way through to Hermann Hesse and all these people, Jung, Romanticism's interest in the East is because it found analogues for its own sort of longing for the infinite. If Romanticism is characterised by longing for the infinite, if that's a definition of Romanticism, then Romanticism found those analogues in India. And it was picking up on certain self-representations of India's traditions concerned with soteriology. Although post-colonial studies have tended to reject all theological inquiry on arguable grounds, it does not follow that any theological or philosophical inquiry should be abandoned to core, completely abandoned. Indeed, were we to do so, this would be a dereliction of intellectual honesty, for soteriologies are clearly an important part of Hindu self-representations in the past, and sometimes, although admittedly problematically, because of colonialism in the present. In my view, there can be an inquiry into Hindu soteriologies that firstly does not ignore the broader political context in which these self-descriptions arose, and secondly assumes the text historical inquiry, i.e. philology, the establishing of texts, critical emendation and so on, within their context. And thirdly, assumes the legitimacy of a theological and philosophical inquiry. So I think you can look at soteriology within India, but you've got to assume all the past scholarship. You've got to assume the political problems, the projections of India as the West Southern and so on. But you've also got to assume the tools of philology and so on. So in a way, theological or philosophical inquiry through the medium of English can only happen after a certain period of time. Once a period of translation has occurred, and once you've got this established text, and once you've done the critical emendation and so on. There is a broader issue here that I can't go into at the moment, namely that religion over the last few decades has been subject to two kinds of reductionism, namely an eliminative materialist reductionism that rejects religious claims within its presuppositions, and secondly a cultural reductionism that reads religious claims only as political claims. So there are these two problems that we have to operate within as well. So like the Dawkins, the self, the God delusion, all that. There's, on the one hand, there's a claim that all religion is nonsense, but dangerous nonsense, moreover, and that we have to understand religion purely in terms of material processes. And on the other, there's a sort of cultural reductionism that has read, like Indon and like Richard King, that reads religious claims purely as disguised political claims, and it's purely a discourse about power. And so when you're studying critically religion in India, you're uncovering a politics of representation. And we in fact dissolve the representations of religion through their analysis. Through the correct analysis of religion, you dissolve it. And indeed, the reduction of fundamental philosophical and religious questions to politics is itself a misrepresentation of Hindu philosophical and theological inquiry through history. And questions such as that posed at the very beginning of the tradition in the Rig Veda, which, as someone reminded me not too long ago, poses the question of why there is being or non-being. One of the hymns, I can't remember which it is now, raises the question, why is there being or non-being? Satarasat. And the translation is something like, only him in highest heaven knows, or perhaps he does not know, which is wonderful beginnings of Indian skepticism. perhaps he does not know. So, we have to begin our inquiry then within these problems. Before we're getting on to it, I'm outlining these problems because I think they're very real and we have to sort of come to grips with them somehow. So there is a legitimacy, I think, to a philosophical and theological inquiry within India, but it does assume that the work of philology and the work of historical inquiry has been done to some extent. So it's a sort of even a tertiary kind of inquiry, tertiary discourse. Now, Indian philosophical discourse has been fundamentally concerned with the question of being and questions of what we might call the human condition, the existential condition, arguably more fundamental than political concerns. Indeed, many of the cultural... the culture despises of religion, as it were, the culturalists, if you like, who critique the notion of religion, sorry, just realised who's sitting here. Sorry, just Alex, I recognise you from
Chris.
I'm sorry. I just recognised you. I thought, I know that face sometime. Anyway, sorry. Sorry, I got distracted. Then I was miles away.
Sorry, my fault.
Yeah, it's your fault. So, the philosophical discourse I'm concerned with. The category politics itself. Arose in 5th century Athens. So, many of the cultural critics of the notion of religion are sort of perhaps blind to the origins of the category politics itself, and assume that as a basic category of human discourse. Anyway. So anyway, Indian philosophical conditions have been fundamentally concerned with the question of being and the existential condition, arguably more fundamental than political concerns, namely that human beings are bound by the narrative or temporal structure of being born, living and dying. We're all born and we all live and we all die. And while, of course, political concerns are important, so too are these, to my mind, equally important problems that, while they interface with politics, cannot be reduced to politics. The world binds us. We are bound by its physicality, by temporality, and by desires. And freedom in Indian traditions might be seen primarily as freedom from these bonds. So the human condition in pre-modern India, the second category, second on the handout there. So among the earliest systematic formulation of ideas about the human condition come from outside the Vedic fold, in the Shramana traditions of Buddhism and Jainism and the Ajivikas. Although very quickly these systematic speculations develop within Hindu traditions as well. Indeed, common to the Shramana traditions and early Brahmanical speculations such as Yoga and Samkhya, we have the idea that life is suffering or dissatisfactory, is dukkha. These Shramana traditions develop from about 800 to 400 BCE, and texts in Sanskrit and Prakrit bear witness to the emergence of a new ideology of renunciation in which knowledge or cognition is given precedence over action, karma, and detachment from the material world is cultivated through ascetic practice, tapas, celibacy, poverty, and methods of mental training, yoga. So in the, I don't know if how familiar any of you are with these categories, but you have the Vedic tradition, the mainline Vedika tradition, which is concerned with Brahmanical ritual, one word for which was karma, action, ritual action. And then you get these other alternative kind of traditions which call themselves Shramana traditions or Samana traditions. And an early distinction in Hindu, well, in Brahmanical texts, is between the Shramanas and the Brahmanas. And Romila Thapar, for example, says that these two groups were antagonistic towards each other, as a snake and a mongoose. Mm-hmm. So were the Shramanas and the Brahmanas. And the shamanic traditions, particularly of Buddhism and Jainism, which were rejecting Vedic ritual, rejecting Brahmanical categories, and saying that you can have liberation from a cycle of rebirth, cycle of reincarnation, through the detachment from action, through stopping acting, particularly in Jainism, and in Buddhism, through stopping craving. And these traditions also develop within India, and as we saw last term, with the Upanishads, these later Vedic texts, probably beginning to be composed about 800 BC, you get the development of these practices of asceticism, tapas, heat, some of which, well, there's two debates. One, do these practices come from outside, from the Shramana traditions, or do they develop inherently within the Brahmanical tradition? And there's arguments on both sides. It's probably a complex process of both. So you get these developing within India, within the Hindu Brahmanical traditions. Sometimes I use the word Hindu, although you must be aware, of course, that the word Hindu wasn't used until the 15th century or so. But I sort of sometimes tend to project it back. The Shramana traditions differ on points of doctrine and method, but generally agree that life is characterized by suffering. And it's the first truth of the Noble One, the Buddha. So I tend to think, rather than the Four Noble Truths, I think it's probably the Four Truths of the Noble One, if that's a Tapurusha compound. And is the opening verse of the Samkhya Karikas, the Samkhya text that I mentioned Samkhya last term. It's one of the earliest philosophical traditions of India, which we're going to be looking at, as we'll see. And this suffering came in due course to be associated with the transmigratory existence and the idea that to be born into the world is to suffer, and freedom from suffering, moksha, nirvana, mukti, is the cessation of birth into the world. So that became a very important idea in these Shramana traditions. Furthermore, this freedom from suffering is a form of higher gnosis or cognition, jnana, vidya. The spread of disease among the new urban populations of the Ganges Plain may have been partly responsible for the development of this idea of suffering and the Shramana response to it. And Richard Gombrich has pointed this out in his book, Theravada Buddhism. It's quite an interesting angle. But even so, the point, whether that's true or not, whether there was, because of urbanisation in the Ganges Plain, whether there was a sort of rapid spread of disease, the broader point is about the human condition remains. Okay, so first of all then, the human condition is one of suffering in these early traditions. And so liberation or salvation is liberation from that condition of suffering, which is being born again and again and again, rebirth. And as we saw last term, in the Vedic tradition, the earliest Vedic rituals were intended to prevent re-death, punamrityu. But then later, it got the idea of rebirth and stopping rebirth came in. Because in the... You may be familiar with this, but you have two different sort of models. The Vedic model is... the world, and then you have, when you die, you go into the realm of the ghosts, the Pratas, the Prataloka, and then after 10 months, when your body is fully formed, you get fed pindas in the other world, and then you go up into the realm of the ancestors, the fathers, the Pitriloka, for 4 generations, and then you go into the old gods, the Vishri, Deva. That was the earlier model, and then with the Upanishads, this they try to square this model with reincarnation. Now, the Shramanas rejected that model and said that you get reborn, you come back into the world. So the earlier, the Vedic model is rejected by the Shramana tradition. So you don't have to do your rituals and so on. You have to stop rebirth through detachment. So the highest human good, then, there are different views of the human good in these early traditions. And what is a human good? The term is purusharta, the human goals of life, if you like. Now, if suffering is a description of the human condition in these traditions, then they also posit the idea of a human good, the highest human good. The ultimate human good for the renouncer traditions is world transcendence and going beyond the process of birth and death. Indeed, these renouncer traditions espouse values of asceticism in contrast to the Brahmanical householder value of affirming the goals of worldly responsibility, dharma, worldly success and profit, artha, erotic and aesthetic pleasure, karma. And the fourth goal, liberation, was added later as the ultimate human good. This may be to recap what we did last term, but you have these four goals of dharma, particularly with regard to your caste and stage of life. Your varna and ashrama. Apologize for those for whom this is repetition. And then we have artha, wealth or worldly success, and karma, pleasure. Karma Sutra, Karma Shastra, the Artha Shastra, and Dharma texts as well. And the fourth goal of life, which gets added later on, is moksha, or liberation. So the original goals of the original highest goods in the Brahmanical traditions are social responsibility and duty, wealth and pleasure. So, having fun and getting rich if you can. And then that gets rejected by this other goal, this worldly transcendence of moksha that gets added on. And some argue that that's because it's coming in from outside, it's coming in from the Shramana traditions. But there is a logic within the Vedic tradition itself which could come up with that notion, I think. Now, artha can be rendered as goal, but they really refer more to realms of value, or in Karl Potter's terms, attitudes. There is some debate about the ascendancy, which is more important than others. Now, whereas the first three goals can be understood in terms of morality, the fourth goal, moksha, cannot be understood wholly in terms of morality, but rather in terms of freedom. And freedom rather than morality becomes the highest good. Now that's an interesting idea, because do you have to be a completely immoral person to get to moksha? And that's a question which is variable answers to that in the Indian traditions. Certainly in Buddhism, for example, you get people being liberated who were fairly wicked. Angulimala, the one who had the string of thumbs, who got liberated by the Buddha. The Buddha appeared to him, and he was going to, for some magical reasons, he has to collect these thumbs, and he's got 99 or something, and he has to get 100. Do you remember this story? And Angulimala, and the Buddha appears to him, Angulimala wants to kill the Buddha and get his thumb for some magical purpose. But the Buddha converts him to Buddhism, and he becomes liberated, he becomes an arahant, and he has this awakening liberation, and all his karma, most of his karma is burned up, most of his bad deeds are burned up in this liberating experience. But the Buddha says you have to pay for it a bit, so I think people chuck bricks at him and stuff when he goes into villages, but on the whole, most of his murders are eradicated by the liberating experience. So there's a distinction between ethics and freedom, which is quite interesting. Now, the ashrama system, this idea that there are different human goods for different people and different stages of life, becomes formalized in what's called the ashrama system. And that there are four fundamental stages of life: the student stage, where you study the Veda, a householder stage where you get married and fulfill the goals of dharma, of duty, wealth, and pleasure. The hermit stage, or the wilderness dweller, and the renouncer. As a householder, the good Brahmin can fulfill the goals of dharma, arta, and karma. But as a renouncer, he can fulfill the goal of liberation or salvation from life. And here the ultimate good becomes the negation of those other worldly goods. Now, what then is meant by liberation as the highest human good? Is it akin to a utopia in which everyone lives together in peace and happiness? Generally, no. Liberation is conceptualized more as an individual state, which is either escape from the world or seeing the world transformed. You do get some ideas, particularly in the Bhakti traditions, of a sort of shared liberation, I think, or shared condition of liberation. But it's not like a collective utopia. There are a number of terms are used. Let's look more closely at some of these sources. Perhaps we can do that next week. But you've got the Brihadaranyaka. Perhaps you'd like to look this up yourself. You've got the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 3:1-6. You've got the term mukti and moksha occurring there. 4:2-4, and the Mundaka Upanishad 3:2-6 and 3:2-9. The term Kaivalya does not occur in the early Upanishads, and Nirvana does occur in the Bhagavad Gita, but not the early Upanishads. You've got a variety of terminologies that are used for this idea of liberation. But I won't go into I won't go into the actual text, but perhaps you can look at those yourself. So soteriology and the formation of ethical communities. The search for the highest good, although individualistic, resulted in the formation of ethical communities, the Sangha or group of renouncers. So Louis Dumont made a distinction between world renunciation, between the householder traditions of India and world renouncer traditions, and said that there was a tension between world affirmation and the householder traditions, and world denial in the renouncer traditions. And he argued that the renouncers were the most individual of individuals, if you like, that the renouncers became individual, and whereas the householder was a purely social being, was not an individual in any developed sense. Now, you could argue, Alexis Arnason, for example, argues that actually it's the other way around in many ways, that the Brahmin householder is the most individual of individuals, demarcating himself from his surroundings through various ritual procedures to protect his ritual purity.
Sorry, who argued that?
Alexis Arnason in an article, Purity and Power Among the Brahmins of Kashmir. That's a good book that's in, called The Category of the Person by Stephen Lukes and Michael Carruthers, edited by them. It's about 20 years ago now. You could say then that while the renouncer actually doesn't become individual, but there's an intensive... If you make a distinction between individuality and subjectivity, which I think is legitimate to make, you could argue that with the renouncer traditions, you get an intensification of subjectivity, but they're not individual. They're eradicating individuality. Because, and indeed, that's the intention, to eradicate individuality through acts of will, through acts of asceticism. But nevertheless, there's an intensification of subjective experience, of subjectivity. They become one with a larger group. You get rid of your name, for example. You take on a different name. You look the same as everybody else. You shave your head, or you wear orange robes, or whatever. So there's a kind of an eradication of individuality, but simultaneously an intensification of subjectivity through kind of religious experience, if you like, or through an attempted gaining of this goal of liberation. So soteriology remains individualistic in a sense, but more sort of subject, it's an intensification of subjectivity, but it's not individual in a sense of, in a Western developed sense of the citizen. And there's no communal salvation, or very little. Perhaps in the medieval tradition, Bhakti traditions, you get some idea of communal or shared liberation. So concepts of liberation, then, there's a negative understanding of the highest good. That the highest good cannot be articulated in language, as we saw last term, neti neti, naiti naiti, not thus. You also get positive understandings, the goal as a place, the further shore in Buddhism, nirvana is the further shore, you cross the ocean of samsara to get to the further shore. You get to or the a place such as the Brahma Loka, the heaven of Brahma, heaven. The Shiva Loka, Vaikuntha, and Vaishnavism. So you get the idea that you get positive conceptualizations of the goal of liberation, which is the other place, another place that you go to, heaven or whatever. And the goal of, as conceptualized as transcendence, the world becomes thinner as liberation opens out. So the notion of Kaivalya, for example, which we'll be looking at next time, as your liberation becomes more intense or increases, so the world becomes decreases, as it were. Liberation opens out and the world contracts. And you get this in Shaiva Siddhanta, for example. As you go up through the hierarchy of the universe, closer to the goal of liberation, so the world becomes thinner, becomes less. And as there's an opening out of liberation, so there's a contraction of the world. You get this systole, diastole kind of movement in these traditions. So you've got a number of conceptualizations. Firstly, and the goal is the goal of liberation is a place that you go to, the furthest shore. Here I am, I get to liberation, which is over there. How do I get there? Following these steps A, B, and C. Secondly, you get the goal of liberation as a transcendence of the world. The world becomes thinner as liberation opens out and becomes fuller. Thirdly, you get the goal of transcendence, which is not an emptying of the world, but a realization of the world in its fullness. You get this in some monistic traditions, such as the Pratyabhijna, the Kashmir Shaivism that we'll be looking at in the course. So liberation is not the world doesn't disappear, the world appears in its fullness, and you understand the world as consciousness. And then perhaps fourthly, you get the idea of the world as a kind of perception or cognition, liberation as a kind of cognition or perception. So I suppose the big categorization is liberation as a place that you go to versus liberation as a way of looking at the world, as a process of cognition. So you change your perception of the world and you're liberated. Liberation is a change, a shift of cognition. As you look into the corner for Shankara, you see a snake in the corner, then you recognize it as a rope. That sudden gestalt, that sudden recognition, is seeing the world as a liberated state.
Can I ask something?
Yeah, yeah.
I might sound silly, but what is included in the idea of cognition when you say it's a shift in cognition? How far-reaching is that, if you see what I mean? Is it just that?
Oh yeah, it's complete. Yeah, is it a rational intellectual process?
Yeah.
And I think not in these traditions.
Yeah.
It's not really like seeing, recognizing
yeah.
a rope as a snake.
Yeah.
It's a radical transformation of your whole
yeah.
being, really,
yeah.
Complete disruption of the way you were. So certainly, if liberation is characterized as becoming omniscient and omnipotent, it certainly is a radical shift. In cognition. So it's not like thinking, it's not like rational thinking. It's a disruption of thought, in fact, it's a disruption of language. But it certainly seems to be a kind of perception. The world is transformed in a liberating experience. Now, I mean, for example, in Shankara's notions, does the world, when you get liberated, when you have Jivan Mukti, liberated in the world, does the world disappear? Or is it transformed in your perception? That's an interesting question. certainly in some yoga traditions, the world disappears and you only get full liberation at death.
Surely, this is the second one. It's transporting your perception. It implies that the world is real and objective. If it disappears, it implies the nothingness.
Or is my mind
too Western?
No, I think you could, or you could say that actually liberation is another place, somewhere else that you go to. It's not this world. But there is that implication that the world, if the world disappears and liberation is there, it's difficult to understand what that means, but yeah, that's right.
Buddha was very much alive and liberated in this world.
Say it again.
Buddha was very much alive but liberated in this very world.
That's right. The Jivamukti is very much alive but liberated in this world. And so that person's perception is different from what they were previously. And here we have a problem of relation of the goal to path, and how can liberation be attained by a method? If liberation is the truth of the world, as it were, and we're all, as many traditions say, we're actually already liberated, but we just don't know it. If that's the case, how can it be attained by a method? How can liberation be caused? And this was one of the problems that the Buddhists faced, and indeed some of the medieval Hindu traditions. And the idea of a method implies control, but is liberation to control? Or is it more like loving or breathing? Is liberation more like falling in love or more like breathing rather than like a control, as implied by some traditions such as yoga? Is liberation a cognition or a knowledge that we do not control anything? Is liberation actually the recognition that human beings are not in control of anything? Hence the emphasis on some traditions of letting go. Let go your attachments. A recognition of impotence, a recognition of human impotence in the world. So is liberation more like a skill than a place or a state? So certainly perhaps for the monistic traditions, liberation seems to be more like a skill, a way of being in the world, rather than a state or a place that you go to. In Theravada Buddhism, it seems to be a place. Nirvana is the further shore. You cross the ocean of samsara to get to the further shore. But it's also, arguably, there are elements there which think it's a skill of being, a skillful consciousness. And this is, in turn, this problematic itself is related to problems of causation in India. So the various Indian theories of causation that perhaps I don't want to go into now, that are related to these different conceptions of liberation and related to different theories of causation in India. So if you have the idea of, say, an effect is pre-existent in its cause, the Satkaryavada theory, as a pot pre-exists in the clay, so liberation pre-exists within you, but you have to realise it, you have to cause it through a process of effort. Or if there's a sudden recognition, that's like a Vivarta theory of causation, there's a sudden recognition that you're liberated, that the world is not as it seems, is an illusion as we experience it. As somebody sees silver coins in the sand but discovers they're shells, that's not a real transformation but the mere appearance of a cause. The shells are the cause of the effect, the perception of silver, but there's no real transformation of substance occurs, as in these other theories of causation. So in one, the effect is pre-existent in the cause. The goal and the path are distinct. The path leads to the goal. And the other, the goal and the path are not distinct. The liberation is its own path, as it were. The path to liberation is liberation, is recognition, is waking up. Goal and path are the same. Where I see in some of these Shaiva texts, the Vijnana Bhairava says, "Where can the mind go that is not Shiva?" So how can you cause liberation? Because even ignorance is the condition of being Shiva. And is liberation the obliteration of all identity as a subject to first-person predicates? So is that I want a cup of tea or I want to go to the pictures? Is that the socially constructed personality or what they, in linguistics they call the indexical I, the I which is used in a particular context? Is liberation the obliteration of that identity, of that social identity, of the obliteration of the indexical I? Or is there something that remains? Can liberated people still... could yeah, can Shankara rather have had sugar in his tea or not? I mean, can you have preferences if you're a liberated person? Or is it a complete obliteration of that previous identity? Certainly in theistic traditions there's a preservation of identity. So Vaikuntha, you become an individual, you retain your individuality and you realise the fullness of your individuality in liberation. And then another problem is liberation in life versus liberation in death. Some maintain that some traditions say you can be liberated in this life, and some only at death. Only full liberation occurs at death once the world disappears for you. And the ultimate good becomes the ultimate power. Is liberation complete self-control and control over your immediate environment? So there are different paths then in Indian traditions, the history of Indian traditions, to the ultimate human good, to liberation. And you get the problem of is liberation a sudden waking up, or is it a gradual process of awakening? Is it a gradual or sudden path? You get the problem of causation, and you get problems of gender and soteriology. Can women be liberated in these early traditions? That's a problem in Buddhism as well. These are male constructions. These traditions are written by men, for men generally. Bhakti traditions come along and they're more egalitarian, and they say that women have an equal access to liberation. And Shaiva Siddhanta did as well. And then you have the problem of soteriology in modernity, liberation in the modern context. Freedom, the notion of freedom is linked in the modern view to the self as the autonomous agent. Kant's autonomous self, what is enlightenment? He says self-autonomy, not heteronomy. And you get sort of an ethics of authenticity, to be free, is to be free to be your true self, as it were, to express yourself in an authentic way. And there's an apparent proclamation of freedom by Indian or Indian-influenced gurus. It's still modernism in contrast to the ascetic self, if you like, which is the internalization of traditions, which I haven't really got time to go into now. So tradition views a person on the path to liberation quite distinct from that of modernity's influences on individuality and the ethics of authenticity. So perhaps I'll end on that. That in the history of Indian traditions, the notion of liberation is different from the Western notion of individuality, which emphasises ethics and the modernist view of individuality, which emphasises ethics and authenticity. And to what extent are these views compatible with each other? To what extent can they rest together? In contemporary India, you get both understandings, and indeed, somebody, as we were saying the other day, you get these big yoga schools in India. You know, the idea of liberation is still very vibrant in India, and yet, how does that square with notions of individuality and the ethics of authenticity, which are also developing out of modernity? So those are some of the questions and problems that I hope to be looking at in the history of the particular traditions as we go through the course in the coming few weeks. So thanks for your attention. Any questions before we fold up or comments?
So when you're talking about the human good, is that really just an individual good that you're talking about and not encompassing good of humanity, but an individual good?
Yeah, I think liberation in the Indian context is an individual good, I would think, more than the good of the collective good. Although ultimately everyone should be liberated in the ideology of the Hindu tradition.
But it's a personal responsibility, kind of idea.
Yeah, I think so, more than a collective. Yeah, there's, I don't think there's an Indian sort of Russian thing of Slavia, subornos, a sort of collective salvation. But I think that, you might want to correct me, but I think that's absent in the Indian traditions.
I think it is as well.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.